Welcome to The Sandman Slept Here, part of the Justice Society Presents feed on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I am one of your co-hosts, Max Romero, alongside Ryan Daly and Paul Kien. How are you doing, guys?
Doing great. How are you, Max?
I'm doing good. Ryan?
I'm doing fantastic.
That's what we like to hear, right? On this show, we review the comic book adventures of the Golden Age hero Wesley Dodds, known as The Sandman, with a particular focus on the 1990s Vertigo series Sandman Mystery Theater. In this episode, we'll be looking at Sandman Mystery Theater Annual, number one, the only annual in this series, as well as a Golden Age story from Adventure Comics 47. Guys, this is a little different for us. We're taking a break from the normal continuity to take a look at the annual's a little bit in the continuity, but the Golden Age story is not. Who wants to share why we're sharing that story?
I think we sort of talked about this from the beginning almost. We wanted to, going all the way back to our zero episode when we looked at the first published appearance of the Sandman in the World's Fair comics, we were always like, it'd be fun to kind of dip back when an occasion calls for it to talk about one of the Golden Age stories, and knowing that this annual that we were going to cover would be sort of shorter than the story arcs that we usually cover, which are four issues long. So we would have some time to kind of push out, let's take a look at like a short story from the 40s or something like that and kind of compare the two. But yeah, the annual, and we'll get more into this, but it came out in the middle of the previous story arc that we were talking about in the last episode, Scorpion. But where it takes place is a little nebulous. We kind of have to still kind of figure that out because, and we'll hear this, but in the story, like, they've already done the Buster Calhoun show that they went to in the first arc, the first act of the Scorpion. But it doesn't seem like Diane is all that suspicious of Wesley like she was at the end of that story arc. But this annual also takes place over a little bit of time, so it might take us a little while to figure out exactly where this fits in.
Yeah.
And our Golden Age story, we chose that because it's the first appearance of Diane.
Mm-hmm.
And she is very different than what we're used to.
Yeah, it's very different.
So that'll be interesting to talk about. She's, she is not the Diane that we have been dealing with in the Sandman Mystery Theater. That'll be some interesting things to look at. But before we do that, this episode is sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Running the Fire and Water Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting. A while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses, so we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. If you are enjoying shows on the Justice Society Presents podcast feed, the best way to support the show is by visiting www.patreon.com/FWpodcasts.
And while you're there, please consider supporting the Fire and Water Podcast Network. At certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on the show of your choice, just like our all-star squadron of supporters who ask to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents podcast. Our thanks to
Alex Asias,
Bill Baer,
Bruno Diaz,
Chris Mort,
Craig Fletcher,
DC Dave,
Devin Clancy,
Extremely Uncanny,
George Van Note,
Jason Keen,
Jeffrey Owens,
Keith G. Baker,
Kevin Wetter,
Mark Baker Wright,
Matt Ev,
Michael Bailey,
Michael Crouch,
Mike Zomkowski,
Roger Preeb,
Russell Burbage,
Symbol Pending,
Ted Killington,
and Tim Price.
Again, please visit our Patreon at www.patreon.com/FWpodcasts.
So if you want to read along and you don't have the original issues, where can you do that? So the digital is available on the DC Universe app, but you need the Ultra subscription to read Vertigo books. However, the annual is not actually on the app, believe it or not. So you might need either the issue or, a better choice, in my opinion, the first half of the series was reprinted in several trades, as well as Compendium Volume 1. So I'm reading from Compendium Volume 1, and the annual is in that. Volume 2 did come out last year and is the only place most of the second half of the series has been reprinted at all. And just to give you the details, Sandman Mystery Theater Annual Number 1 has an October 1994 cover date and an on-sale date of August 30, 1994. As Ryan said, it came out the same month as Sandman Mystery Theater Number 19, which was Act 3 of The Scorpion. So why don't we talk about the cover? What'd you guys think? So, Ryan, what'd you think?
It's pink. It's cool. It's a, well, there's a nice contrast of green and pink. It's a shot inside the park. We get a lush trees and foliage, but the all of the sort of background, not exactly negative space, but sort of like the push beyond that is very pink. And we get an image of a masked figure that kind of looks like the Sandman a little bit, not exactly. And that's kind of relevant to who our antagonist is in this story. Somebody who vaguely looks like the Sandman, but isn't exactly. So that contrast of color makes it stand out. At the same time, maybe there's something about it that looks a little bit out of focus or like too soft. Not, I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, it is very pink, very, very pink and green Maybelline, you know, design going here. I think there's a lot going on. And, you know, just to get a little bit ahead, this story takes place exclusively in Central Park in New York. And so we get a bunch, there's a lot of trees that are kind of framing this larger image of the masked man. There's some stuff in the foreground. There's a man standing on, I'm not sure if those are stairs, steps or what that is exactly, maybe. But all that kind of gets lost for me. In a way, it kind of takes away the impact of this cover. And I also don't like the logo treatment. The mystery in Sandman Mystery Theater is kind of pushed back behind the rest of it so that they can get annual in there. But I don't think it quite works. I don't know what you think, Paul.
Yeah, I noticed that about the logo, too. It's a little different, but, it you know, it's supposed to be a little different. It's the annual. I can accept that. I thought it was a little dull, actually. Nothing's really happening on the cover. We have this image of the guy. I think once you read the story, you get it, right? So you read the story, you come back. Unlike some of the other covers we talked about, which, you know, still don't make sense to me, this one, it makes sense once you read the story. So that's kind of good. And I think that thing in the foreground is a bridge, Matt. And I think that gentleman there in the hat is standing on the bridge looking out over the water somehow. You know, it's a little abstract. I think you're meant to think that the guy in pink is the Sandman until you look a little closer and you're like, well, that's not really, doesn't really look like the Sandman when you look closely. But, you know, that's the point. I mean, that's, the, you know, that makes sense in the context of the story.
You mentioned that, you know, maybe it works better after you've read the story and you come back to it. But is that beside the point of a cover?
Yeah, I agreed. Agreed.
You know, I mean, should this, you know, is that kind of, is this cover kind of working backwards, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, if I hadn't been reading Sandman Mystery Theater, would I want to just pick up this annual? Because, you know, sometimes people pick up annuals on a whim. But I'm not so sure it works that way.
I agree. That I think I was trying to be more gentle in saying there was something a little bit out of focus or like kind of like hard to attach to when I said that. But I think really, I think I was looking for the word that you said, Max, which was it's dull. It's kind of a dull cover.
Yeah, that was Paul. But yeah, I know I agree. Yeah, just kind of sits there. But the story itself doesn't. I actually really enjoyed this story. So let's get into it.
The story's great. Yeah, let's get into it.
Sandman Mystery Theater Annual Number 1, written by Matt Wagner and Stephen T. Siegel. The artist is Guy Davis, letterer John Costanza, colorist David Hornung, and the editor is Karen Berger. Chapter 1, The Eyewitness, is illustrated by Guy Davis with colors by David Hornung. Wesley Dodds meets Diane Belmont for a leisurely and romantic walk through Central Park. He charms her by quoting the famous artist immortalizes statues in the park. They sit on a bench and begin to kiss. Out of the corner of his eye, though, Wes sees a masked figure emerge from the trees and attack a couple picnicking on the other side of the fountain. More disturbing to Wes than the sudden act of violence is the fact that he had no premonition of it from his dreams.
Chapter 2, The Butler, is illustrated by David Lloyd. Later that day, Wesley returns to the park to investigate the crime he witnessed. This time, he's brought his gentleman's gentleman, Humphreys. As Wes snoops around for clues, Humphreys remembers the day he interviewed for the job and how his respect for his former employer's secrecy appealed to Wes. He also recalls the first time Wes's screams woke him in the middle of the night and the first time he heard other strange noises in the house whose cause he could not account for, and the night that he discovered Wes's secret lab, secret garage, and secret mission.
In Chapter 3, The Stakeout, that's illustrated by John Bolton with colors by David Hornung. That night, the Sandman returns to Central Park again. He sneaks around looking for evildoers, but finds only lovers. That night is a bust.
For him, at least. Chapter 4, The Body, is illustrated by Stefano Guadiano with colors by David Hornung. 2 years earlier, Sal and his buddy, Mario, were also in the park. They noticed a black couple enjoying the day and decided to ruin it for them. Mario held a knife to the man's throat while Sal tried to rape the woman. Then, the Sandman, a sort of prototype version of the Sandman, surprised them and sprayed gas in Sal's face. Mario went for Sandman with his knife, but the black man grabbed his leg and they tumbled. Sal, choking on the gas, tripped and fell right into Mario's knife. The Sandman and Mario each run away, leaving the couple alone with a dead body. Convinced no one would believe the story, the couple buries Sal's body in the park where it has stayed for the last 2 years.
Chapter 5, The Cop, is illustrated by George Pratt with colors by Mike Danza. One hot night in June, Officer Kaufman walks his Central Park beat alone. He sees a local photographer named Fiji who asks if tonight is the night the mugger strikes. Kaufman shoos away a transient and a couple of lovers. He sees the Sandman hiding in a tree and fires his gun. Sandman fires back. Kaufman gets enough of a dose to slow him down, but not knock him out. He chases the Sandman, who runs directly into Fiji, the photographer. Fiji grabs his camera to snap a picture of the masked man just as he shoots his gas gun. Kaufman and Fiji hope the photo of the Sandman, who they think is the mugger, will help catch him, but the picture only caught the swirling cloud of gas.
Chapter 6, The DA, is illustrated by none other than Alex Ross. District Attorney Larry Beaumont takes his lunch break in Central Park with a couple of hot dogs, where he meets Diane and Wesley. Diane chides her father about his diet, and Wes asks if there's any word on the mugger that's been in the news. But back at the office, Lieutenant Burke tells Larry about Officer Kaufman's encounter with the Sandman. Burke has ordered more patrolmen for the park to catch the mugger and or the Sandman, if they're not the same person. After dinner, Larry returns to his office to find the Sandman waiting for him. Their conversation is interrupted when an officer sees the Sandman and takes a face full of sleeping gas. Larry gets a phone call from Diane, saying she's gone to the movies with a friend, but Larry doesn't get a chance to tell her to stay away from the park.
Chapter 7, The Mugger, is illustrated by, I am going to massacre this name, Peter Snidberg, with colors by David Hornung. I am so sorry. After the movie, Diane separates from her friend Lily and walks through Central Park alone. She thinks about the ways her friend has changed, blissfully unaware that she's being followed by a masked man. Just as the mugger is about to attack her, an equestrian rides his horse between them, scaring the mugger off.
Chapter 8, The Bystanders, is illustrated by Dean Ormston with colors by David Hornung. Late at night, the park is quiet, but hardly deserted. A trio of boys hang out in a treehouse listening to the radio. An ice cream vendor and portrait artist both lament the absence of paying customers. A couple of city workers are digging a hole to repair a water pipe. A coachman picks up a couple of lovers and takes them around in his horse-drawn carriage. He pulls over so the lovers can go off into the woods. The mugger surprises the couple and gets a bigger surprise in return. They're undercover cops. He disarms one of the cops and runs, passing the artist as he flees. The other cop opens fire and misses the mugger, striking the horse instead. The mugger takes refuge in the treehouse, scaring the little boys away.
And our final chapter, chapter 9, is called The Solution, and it's illustrated back to Guy Davis with colors by David Hornung. The mugger holds up an elderly couple, but the couple is actually Wesley and Humphreys in disguise. Wes dons his Sandman costume and pursues the mugger through the park. Wes is troubled by the fact that the mugger's gun isn't loaded and that his dreams still have given him no inclination of the man's evil nature. He finally subdues him with his gas. It turns out the mugger is Stanislaus Emrakovic, an out-of-work factory worker with a wife and 5 children to support. He turned to crime in desperation, but never meant to hurt anyone. Sandman puts him to sleep, and when Stanislaus wakes up in his own bed, the Sandman has left him a note along with a lot of cash. Later, the mugger's costume is found abandoned. The police stuff it to give it the appearance of a man wearing the getup. Fiji takes a photo, wondering why the mugger gave up his wicked ways. The end.
So, guys, it seems like a lot is happening in the story, but it's pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a guy mugging people in Central Park. He's dressed kind of weird, and everyone thinks it's the Sandman. And in the end, it actually ends up being kind of sweet. Mm-hmm. So what did you guys think of it? Paul, what did you think?
Well, you know, unlike most of the stories, which are pretty gruesome, this one is very light compared to that. There's some parts that are funny, like Diane walking through with, you know, and things happening behind her that she takes no notice of. And you can see that like in a movie or something where things are happening and the person's just blithely walking through and not noticing stuff. So I like that a lot. I thought it's a great change of pace. You can see that they were clearly trying for something different. The all-star sort of roster of artists illustrating each chapter is a lot of fun. And so I thoroughly enjoyed it. How about you, Ryan?
I like this one a lot, too. And this story I had never read until I was prepping for this episode of the show, because this annual was never reprinted in the early trade paperbacks that came out 20 years ago. They kind of skipped this one, and I never saw it on the stands. I never got it. I didn't know it existed for a long time. So this was a first read for me, and I really, really enjoyed it. It was nice seeing the names of some of the artists who have gone on to do other things. A lot of them were, as we'll kind of see, were staples of British comics and Vertigo titles and stuff around around this time. You're right. It's definitely lighter. It's a little bit sunnier, breezier for kind of being in the park so much. It doesn't have the overwhelming prevalence of like the horrors that Man is capable. However, we do get an attempted rape because.
I'm not saying it's all flowers and ice cream, right?
I was going to say, what has this series done to us that we think of attempted rape and a murder? It's a light story. It's fine.
It's just one. It was a fun story. Lots of dressing up in costumes for different people. Like, you know, the cops going undercover, one of the cops dressing up as a woman as the lovers. Humphrey's dressing up as a woman at one point. The mugger that we'll talk about a little bit in his own kind of costume, which has some weird accents to it that we can talk about. But overall, Max, what did you think about this one?
I actually really liked it quite a bit. Like, as Paul said, it's a change of pace. It's kind of a palate cleanser from what we've seen before. But one of the things that I really like about it is it doesn't hit you over the head with it, but it gives you a lot of early Sandman lore. In the flashbacks, you almost get kind of a Sandman year one. You get to see in, I believe it's The Body, in the chapter The Body, you get to see... an early version of Sandman. You know, his costume's not quite together yet.
His gas gun is just an aerosol can.
Yeah, he's got an aerosol can instead of a gas gun. And I thought that was really kind of neat. I think it also does a nice job of bridging everything that has happened so far, because I think, I want to say like at least three of the previous storylines are mentioned in some way in this story. And I'm really surprised that this was not part of any collection before, because I think it really has, it really provides some glue to what we've had before that is important to the characterization, you know, of especially Wes in his early days. And it's kind of nice also to see, I don't know, you guys have probably been to New York, but, you know, Central Park is huge.
Yeah.
And this story does a really nice job of showing, I mean, even then, the action, most of this takes place in one part of the park, and you still get the sense of the immense size of it. So I thought that was a really kind of done great. Really well. And as we sort of mentioned, every chapter has a different artist. And I think that works really well, too. I don't know what you guys thought.
Yeah, I like the switching of artists. I wasn't sure exactly how that was going to flow, but it really did, because each chapter is almost more like a little vignette because it has like a different POV. It's not just a chapter focusing on Wes as he's going through this investigation. We jump around from what is Diane doing? What is she thinking about? Like the whole thing where she's walking through the park, having a monologue about her inner monologue about her own feelings, completely ignorant of the danger that's literally creeping up on her and would take her out as if not for like a chance passing. We get a chapter of Humphreys, the butler, that we've never spent that much time with, but we've learned so much about him now. I like the character now. It's crazy. And more of that same in lore, because we see how he discovered Wesley's secret from an earlier time in Sandman's life, when he's obviously still not so great at the vigilante thing because he crashes the car. He's unconscious in the garage with his head on the horn. But yeah, just a lot. And like a chapter from the DA's perspective, a chapter narrated by a dead body that's just been buried under the park. That one was fascinating because the whole time I'm like, is this going to come back? Is the mugger a ghost of this Sal guy? Or what was the point of that? I don't know what the point was, but it was cool.
Yeah,
I thought that was really effective. I actually had to go back and go, wait a minute, what did I just read? I had to go back and read that.
I had to read that, reread that too. Definitely. I like the art switches. I mean, a lot of these artists, I've read other things they've done that I like a lot of them, you know, a lot. We can talk about that as we go through each chapter, but, you know, I'm on board with it.
And, of course, I'll go ahead and mention this now. Alex Ross does a chapter here, And this was actually, gosh, just months before Marvel's was released. And so, you know, it was kind of Marvel's was on sale in November 1993. Sandman Mystery Theater Annual was on sale in August. So it was, you know, about 3 months before Alex Ross really kind of became Alex Ross.
Yeah, pretty cool.
That's probably how they got him for a few pages of this one. Probably didn't, he wasn't commanding Alex Ross fees at this point. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. And it's and of course it's a it's
well, but role. let's give credit where credit's due. I mean, Karen Berger was a tremendous talent spotter.
Absolutely,
and she was. Look at this. I mean, she you know, a lot of them are the UK guys, like, you know, David Lloyd and you know, Don Bolton and the rest. But, you know, she was a tremendous talent spotter. So, you know, I think let's give her some credit.
Right.
Yeah.
We should also, I think we should refer to him as friend of the network, Alex Ross.
Sure. Let's do that.
Ryan, did you have any specific thoughts about chapter one, The Eyewitness?
I do like that it's bookended by two Guy Davis chapters.
Yeah.
I think that helps it kind of feel of a piece with the whole theme and like that, the way we think of him. And I maybe I mentioned this on an earlier episode, but he doesn't draw every arc, but he's kind of like the artistic director of it, sort of kind of like set the standard for the template for how the kind of how the book is drawn. So to have him at the front and last chapter is really important. And it's a sweet chapter. It's a nice little day of like Wes and Diane. We see them flirting and their flirtation is always a lot of fun, the way they can tease each other back and forth. We get some dialogue about some of the statuary in Central Park. And Max, I think you'll have something to say about that in a little bit.
Yes.
I like the way it closes up that little, like, even while he's kissing Diane, he can't help but have a wandering eye, and it's not wandering for other ladies. It's wandering for crime, apparently. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he just happens to see this vision of this mugger sneaking up on the couple, and he doesn't freak out right away and go to try and stop it, but he's just like, "Hey, Diane, I gotta go." She's like, why are you tensing up all of a sudden? He's like, "I'm cold. Aren't you cold?"
Yeah.
and that's kind of a hint into, like I said, that we get a little bit of Sandman lore in this annual. We start to understand that his ability to precognition through dreaming is not 100%. It doesn't always work for every crime. And there's a reason is implied later on. Mm-hmm. But I thought that was pretty interesting. And yeah, this is such a children cover years. This is such a horny chapter. these guys are just so into each other, and I love to see it. I love how into each other they are. It's just, I mean, it's just crazy. I mean, if he doesn't tell Diane soon, I don't know what's going to happen. I mean,
Wes calls her a real find.
I'm like, yeah, wow. That's cute. That's cute. Yeah,
yeah. He's got to cool it down there. But yeah, no,
my favorite part was when they're bantering back and forth, walking through, and he buys her a rose and says, I was hoping you'd put the rose in your teeth. And she says, oh, so it'll make me more exotic. She says, no, I was just hoping that you wouldn't sing anymore. And she says, calls him a cad. Just giggling. And it's just adorable. Like, they're generally, when they have scenes like this, adorable. Mm-hmm. Or adorbs, as the kids say.
Yeah. Pretty quickly, we see our mugger, who comes out of the bushes. And I thought that was, I really like the design of the mugger, because, you know, it's more than any other villain that we've seen so far. It's kind of this darker reflection of Wes himself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and we see that in a later chapter, you know, during his early days. And I thought that was interesting. I thought that was an interesting choice. I'm not quite sure what to make of that, but I thought it was a choice that gives you something to think about.
Yeah, and throughout the story, we'll get better looks at him, but essentially, he's just wearing like kind of like just, he's all covered up, but normal street clothes. It's not a costume per se, and he's just wearing what, a full face mask, like ski mask or balaclava or something, but he's got glasses over, but they're very round lensed glasses, which from a distance look like the Sandman's mask. It's just missing the filtration unit on the Sandman's mask, but it like those round eyes that just kind of reflect light and almost look white, which is kind of a signature of the Sandman and a lot of images of him in the story. But he's also got, it's not a hat. It almost looks like a helmet, like a World War One helmet. Like
I think it's a World War One helmet. That's what I thought it was.
A trencher helmet or something like that. Like, almost kind of reminded me of a Jay Garrick type of thing.
Yep.
And then later on, we see he's also wearing like these platforms, like underneath his
shoes. I did not get, when we get to the platform shoes, I want to talk about that, because that that's the one thing I didn't get about the whole business. Like, yeah, why was he doing it?
I was actually wondering, are they platform shoes or are they almost look like cinder blocks?
Yeah, or something like that.
But I can't imagine him running heavy. Around like he does with those.
Right. It's really heavy. Blocks. Yeah.
Yeah, but like, what's the function of them? Like, when I first saw those, I was like, is it a kid? Is it trying to make himself taller or something? Like, I couldn't.
Yeah, that's. I was wondering if it was the same thing, but it's not explained, which is fine. But I can't quite put my finger on what the point of it was either. Except maybe he's just very short without him. Maybe. But yeah, so in chapter two, the butler, we learn a lot about Humphreys, which I thoroughly enjoyed, especially since up to now I've kind of wondered what is Humphreys' deal as far as how much does he know. I mean, he obviously knows that Wes is the Sandman.
Yep.
But that was all we knew. And this chapter tells us how he was hired by Wes, how almost immediately he was taken into his trust to a certain point until finally Humphreys finds out who he is himself. Yep. And it kind of goes from there. And now, I mean, Humphreys just became one of my favorite characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Humphreys is great. And this is the secret origin of Humphreys. It's great. We find out that, you know, his last position, he quit because the master of the house was sexually abusing the maid, found her another job. And then he left from that, but he wouldn't tell Wes the name, which Wes is impressed by. You know, when pushed, he told the story. And but he wouldn't say, you know, he might have been a terrible person, but it was my employer, and I'm not going to give you the name. And Wes was impressed by that, which I thought that was interesting.
There's a little bit of Humphrey's monologue, like the fact that it's like Wes is like, oh, you're very discreet. I like that about you.
Right.
And certain, but Humphrey's is like, oh, great. Now, what's this guy
going
to
do?
Yeah, what's this guy's secret? What does this guy want me to compromise about, like, in order to keep his secret and everything? But we don't get that. And he's like, I soon found out exactly what it was. But, like, yeah, he hears Wes screaming in the night for the first time. And he's like, what is this? And Wes is like, it's okay, just go back to bed. It's like, I'm supposed to ignore this? And he's like, it happens almost every night. And then he starts hearing these other noises, and he calls an exterminator. And
I love that part.
It's not bugs, it's not rats or something. It's not, and he tells Wes about it. He's like, have you heard these noises? And Wes is like, no, I don't know what he's talking about. I probably just, ignore it. Until finally he just hears this, like, crash and, like, a loud sound. He traces it into his room where he finds the secret passageway down to the lab, and then just a garage where Wes is unconscious with his head on the car horn. And he just kind of takes him out. He's like, this is how I found out who he is. And
I've been having his back since. He has his back there. Yeah. So, and we should mention the art in this one is by David Lloyd, who's famous for V for Vendetta. And a lot of other UK stuff. But, most of our listeners would know him from that, I would imagine.
Yeah. I mean, probably have a few Doctor Who fans listening to this show. Yeah. He did a Doctor Who Weekly for a long time, too.
What I like about this chapter, I mean, not only do we learn a lot about Humphreys, but we learn about his personality, about the kind of person he is. Because not only is he discreet in not telling Wes who his former employer was, he also does tell him, I helped this girl, myself. I got her out of this situation.
Yep.
And the first night that Wes has a nightmare, he goes running to go see what's going on. And he says, I can't see. And he puts the glasses on Wes's face himself. In a very, I hate to say fatherly, because that's not the relationship, and it's not quite a partnership, but it kind of is. It's not a Bruce Wayne Alfred sort of situation. The vibe is different, but he is taking care of Wes. And later when they're in the park and Wes is investigating, he doesn't even have to finish asking him. He just says, consider your back watch, sir. Mm-hmm. He is more than a manservant. You know, he's more than an employee. He is a part of this operation. And I kind of love how quickly Wes trusts him with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree.
Clearly he's a man who believes in service and would aspire to service to something greater than himself. And that's why his previous employer was such a problem for him, that when the guy, like he says, you know, when he got the woman, the maid who was sexually abused and got pregnant, when he got her another job after think it's implied that she had the pregnancy terminated and then got rid of her. The boss flips out and Humphrey's for getting rid of her. He's like, hey, I had uses for that girl. And Humphrey's like, well, he regretted that. And then, so it's clearly like he has a sense of righteousness about him that Wesley might have picked up on that too. And when he sees that's what Wes's cause is too, when he knows that what Wes's mission is, then Humphrey's like, yes, I will serve this man faithfully because he is serving society and the world to make it better, to make it safer and more just.
Mm-hmm. So, well said.
Yeah, I think so. Chapter 3 is the stakeout, which for various reasons is actually one of my favorite chapters in this. The artist is John Bolton, who is from, readers might know from Batman, Man-Bat.
Do we know any Man-Bat fans?
I don't know. I don't know. No comment.
Man-Bat, I don't know. But, yeah, I like how kind of murky this chapter is. It's basically just Wesley on a stakeout. It's very short.
And yeah, it's only 3 pages.
Yeah, nothing really happens. It's not a successful stakeout for Wes, but I kind of like that. I kind of like that Wes is being shown basically doing detective work, which is not always glamorous and not always successful right off the bat.
Right.
Yeah, I agree. Not much more to be said. I agree.
Well, why don't you tell us about chapter 4, The Body? Because this is kind of an outlier as far as the rest of the chapters go. And you kind of mentioned that, Ryan, about how, you know, this is told from the point of view of a murder victim.
Yeah, yeah. And this, I mean, it's set in the past. So we get like this, there's a huge party. The park is it's alive with activity. There's a lot of people playing during the day. And these like two hoodlums, hoods, whatever, they kind of see a young black couple, man and woman, enjoying the park. And they're like, we're going to take advantage of that. So they grab these two, you know, they hit the woman, they kind of drag her off. The one guy is holding the man, a knife to the man's throat. And that's when we see the Sandman kind of come out of here in his early guys. He doesn't have the gas mask yet. He just has like a scarf or rag covering his face.
He looks more like the mugger here than he does.
He does actually. And I think that leads to,
I think that's on purpose. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. Yeah. And his spray is just like an aerosol can. He sprays Sal, who's the guy attacking the woman. And then when Mario comes at Wes with a knife, and I even didn't notice it the first time, but he actually cuts Wes. But the man is able to tackle him first because Wes is kind of like shrinking away. And that's why I think Wes runs, is because he's cut. He's bleeding. But yeah, the guy, Sal, falls on his friend's knife and bleeds out. It was just like kind of a fascinating chapter. It's like, what's the point of this? What does this have to do with the whole narrative? And part of it is looking more a little bit at Sandman's past, but it's also giving a voice to the park that you wouldn't otherwise give to a location. It's giving, there's a spirit of this place that is haunted, that has a kind of ghostly presence, even though it's not a ghost involved in the story. But I just thought that was kind of a fascinating thing.
That's a conclusion I came to, too, because I wondered, you know, it doesn't really advance the plot of the mugger at all, right? Mm-hmm. He doesn't appear until the last panel of it, but it is more of a, you can see almost that maybe this idea started out as a bunch of vignettes about Central Park, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I can almost see that being the first idea and then the narrative of the mugger coming later. And then this was maybe one of the ones they thought about first, because, you know, there's a lot different about this chapter. It's 2 years ago. It's a bit longer. Chapter 6 or 7 pages. So anyway, I thought that was interesting. But I came to the same conclusion you did, Ryan.
And this is also the first time we see that the mugger has something, big blocks tied to his feet.
Yeah, that's just weird.
Yeah, I don't know quite what it's supposed to be doing, because I would think that slows him down if he has to run away, as he does later. But, you know, he seems to be handling it okay, I guess. This was an interesting chapter. As I said earlier, I had to read it over again to quite grasp who was talking and what was going on. But I think you guys are right on in terms of this is helping to characterize the park itself, which is, you know, so important to this overall story.
The art in this chapter also is by Stefano Gaudiano, who is much better known as an inker. I think this is maybe the first time I've seen his pencils. And looking at a few of the pages, like the way he draws Sal, like there's almost like a Mike Allred quality, I think, to the way he draws the faces in a couple of shots or something like that. Which is weird because when you look at the work that he's done as an inker, you don't think of Mike Allred at all. And maybe I'm the only one who sees this. But,
well, you know, I didn't see it before, Ryan, but I see it on page, 544 of the and 545, mm-hmm. the close-ups of the guy with the cigarette and the woman. Yeah. They look a little – I could see a little Mike Allred in those two at least. Yeah. I didn't catch that. Good
call. But he was he inked a lot of Michael Lark stuff. Like he worked on Batman, Gotham Central, mm-hmm. The book, and then from that started working on almost everything that Ed Brubaker did. Starting with when Ed Brubaker took over Daredevil, which Michael Lark was drawing some of that. So he would be the inker on that book. And then that continued on to the Captain America run, where he was inking Michael Lark and Butch Geiss. Mm-hmm. And then some of the other like Winter Soldier stories that came off of. But yeah, like a ton of Ed Brubaker stuff in like the early and mid 2000s.
Who it reminded me of, especially I think this is pages 4 and 5 of the chapter, which is when they're threatening the couple and Sandman makes his appearance. The faces of a couple of these characters actually remind me of Paul Pope.
I can see that.
Who I'm a big fan of. So, yeah, I mean, I wasn't sure how to feel about the art on this chapter, to be honest, at the first time I read through it. But I do think it works, you know, and I do think it, for some reason, and I got, that, again, that I can't put my finger on, it does give that feeling of being a flashback. Mm-hmm. You know, it's.
I think it's the coloring is mm-hmm. different on this. I think it's more, I don't know if sepia is the right word, but it's more muted or something. I'm not very good at the coloring terminology, but yeah. I think it definitely, you know, it's a flashback because of that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and that's a good point because David Hornung, I believe, does the coloring throughout, right? And the coloring is not static. You know, the coloring, as you guys have, you know, as you just mentioned, it really kind of is suited to the art and to what is going on in that chapter. So I think David Hornung has actually done an excellent job in this issue.
Agree.
So the next chapter is chapter 5, The Cop. The art on this is by George Pratt, who I'm not actually very familiar with, to be honest.
The thing I know him most from is the Enemy Ace graphic novel, War Idol, which I read a couple of years ago. It's actually unbelievable art in that book. But I don't know a whole lot. I know he did some Wolverine for a while, but that's about it. I don't know a whole lot of other things he did, mainstream stuff, you know.
Yeah, the lines are thick and squiggly, and it has kind of a rough draft look to it. But I actually really enjoy the art in this mm-hmm. chapter for some reason.
Well, he definitely fits in the spirit of the Sandman Mystery Theater. You know, I think this art is, I think it fits.
Mm-hmm. This is the chapter that has the image of Sandman sitting in a tree where he looks like some sort of, you know, haunted bird or something. And, you know, and I think it's just some of the imagery in this is just beautiful. And as it shows different perspectives of kind of the same story that's going on. And I really like that this cop acts like a cop. You know, he acts like a beat cop who is just trying to get mm-hmm. through his shift, but at the same time jumps into action when he sees who he thinks is, you know, the bad guy. Not very successfully, but he does.
Yep.
And, you know, I thought this was a kind of a cool little chapter to bridge things. And Paul, what did you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's neat. Again, I think a lot of this purpose is, again, focused on the park and the things happening in the park. We don't see the mugger again. We see Wes and then he runs away from the cop and gasses him and runs flat into the photographer who we did see a couple chapters ago. So that's kind of neat. And and then I love how the picture that he gets is just of the gas. I thought that was a funny way to end it.
The second page of this chapter, that close up shot of the photographer Fiji, that's such a great picture. Like that's like a. Mm-hmm. You can see that Depression era photo face, like an era face in a photo. Such an expressive face. It looks so real. The other thing I liked was how like the art kind of loosens up once the chase starts. The definition mm-hmm. get a little bit crazier. The proportions, like Sandman's kind of gets exaggerated, like he's drawing out, like he's racing. There's kind of like a crazy animated quality to it where you really start to see like, okay, the story is speeding up. So the art gets faster and kind of a little bit looser. And I like that.
Yeah, I agree. You're right. There are fewer panels until at least that splash page, the second to the last. That's a good point. Yeah.
You know, and again, Hornung makes some interesting choices here. It's very murky, very dark, and almost everyone's face throughout the story is just completely white, not colored in at all, which I think is a neat way to indicate that this is nighttime and this is probably like moonlight, you know, reflecting off of people's faces.
That's a good shot.
Yeah, that's a good call. I didn't catch that, but you're 100% right. That's cool.
I think that is such a great choice. I think that is just one of the things that I like so much about this chapter is just how well the art and the coloring works together.
Well, and then on the last page, when they actually taking the picture, it because of the flash, you can see the giant flash bulb. It's all black and white because the flash, takes over the whole sort of immediate area. So pretty cool.
Yeah. And of course, I always love people's reactions to getting gassed by the by Someone's always going, "Oh, you son of a bitch. Oh, you bastard." They're
Yeah,
probably
they all
coughing
hate
their
it.
lungs out.
Yeah, they all hate it. And I love like
the first reaction of the cop is like, "What the heck did he spray me with?" Like if you don't know who the Sandman is or what his name is, like, "Am I dying? Did I just breathe in like some like mustard gas or some horrible like toxin?"
Exactly. So, chapter six is the DA, and we get some time with Larry Belmont, and you know he we have something in common, a love for hot dogs.
And need to work on our diets. At least I
That
do.
too. But as we mentioned before, this is by art with Alex Ross. And you know it is undeniably Alex Ross art. You know it's
And we're not just saying that because he's a friend of the network.
you know, and this is
Just hyper
probably
realistic.
and probably the most handsome version of West that we've gotten so far.
Oh, by far. Yeah, good point.
You know, and Diane, of course, looks great too, but we don't get to, she's under a sun hat, so we don't get to see
Yeah, we don't
much of
see her
her.
much. Yeah.
But yeah, so Ryan, what did you think of this?
I actually, it just occurred to me, I don't think he will ever draw Wes like this again because in Kingdom Come, Wes is very old in that, like in the first chapter. I like this. Like, I mean, for me, like the thing about this was it gives us a little bit more of a timestamp because the DA is actually referencing the cases that we've seen at this one. He mentions like the Eldridge Benson case. He's like, what kind of man would try to start a race war? It's like, oh yeah, that was from the face. He talks about like, oh, Miriam Goldman. It's like, what was wrong with her from the tarantula? He mentions the Buster Calhoun show that they went to. He's like, that was from the scorpion. He mentioned the Arthur Riesling case. It's like, oh yeah, he got caught in the brute. So we know this is definitely taking place after those stories that we've seen, but it's also reminding us that this is still canon, I guess, like it's in the continuity, like it's part of this world, and the events that we see play out, not just the ongoing romance and the story of Wes and Diane together, but the events that the Sandman, the people that he's fighting, have consequences that are continuing. And even if this is only the only time they ever get mentioned again, we know that these things played out, that the characters that he catches go to trial for good or bad, however that ends up. But it's a nice little reminder that those events happened and they weren't inconsequential.
Okay.
And we also get a look at a very dapper Burke, Detective Burke, who shares a swig of something out of a flask with the DA.
But that was my favorite part because again, the mystery that is Burke, right? Burke doesn't just jump on the bank. He gets the sketch. It looks a little like Sandman. Doesn't just jump on it, but he's willing to think that the Sandman is either the bad guy or he's after the bad guy. So I thought that was, again, I guess my nose perks up. Or ears, but I don't know what perks up. Well, maybe
Hey,
we
now.
shouldn't say, hey, it's a family show. But whenever Burke comes around, because I'm curious what he's going to do next. And then this time, he's actually acting like a cop, saying, all right, well, it could be Sandman, but it could be that Sandman's chasing this guy. So let's go see what happens. So I thought that was fascinating.
It's interesting that he's coming to the conclusion on his own because he's not getting visited by the Sandman
Like,
like
yeah,
DA
yeah.
Belmont is,
Yep.
but he's coming to the same conclusion that maybe the Sandman's not a bad guy, you know?
Yep.
And it's interesting to see he's doing such a great job of organically putting things in place.
You can see why Alex Ross is such a master, though, too, because look at the lighting. In the scene in the DA's office, he comes in, it's all dark. He turns on his desk light, and there's a Sandman in the corner, and you can see him just backlit by the strips of light through the louvers on the window. Just fabulous. And then just the way that the light shines off. I mean, he's famous for working with models. You can see he had somebody sit there and shine a light a certain way to see where the shadows would play out. I mean, it just, it's really remarkable. On the next page, he's standing there, and then the other cop comes in, and then he has to gas him, unfortunately. But but I just, you know, you can just see why he's, you know, why he is who he is. You can see the beginnings of it here, because he certainly had talent from the get-go.
And I do like that Belmont is quick on the fan.
Yeah.
He's ready
for it.
It's a hot summer. They have to have a desk fan.
But he puts it to work and he keeps himself conscious.
Yes. Yeah.
So yeah, this is of course it's a beautifully illustrated chapter. And it's nice to get a little kind of peek into D.A. Belmont's office life. You know, we've seen him running around the crime scenes and telling Diane to, you know, go to bed. But it's interesting to kind of see him at work.
And this is the only one where the end of that scene leads into the next chapter, because he gets a call from Diane telling him that she's gone to the movies. He's like, sure, have fun. And she hangs up before you say, but stay out of the park. And of course, what does Diane do? Being Diane, she walks right through the middle of the park.
Right into the park. That's chapter 7, the mugger. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Paul, what did you tell us about this chapter?
I enjoyed this one. This one, again, I thought this was humorous because, again, it's basically 3 pages of Diane. She leaves her friend after the movies, walks through the park, and the mugger is, you know, she walks past the World War I memorial, and then up on the memorial is the mugger wearing one of those helmets, and he jumps down. He's chasing after her, but every time he gets close to her, there's somebody else around, and he doesn't want any other witnesses. As we find out later, he doesn't really want to hurt Diane. He wants to scare her into giving him her purse, right? Mm-hmm. And he's about to catch up to her, and I love, and then the horse comes running through and knocks into him, and Diane gets to the edge of the park and out on the street, and he's thwarted. So I don't know if it's intended to be humorous. I took it as humorous with a bunch of lucky coincidences on Diane's part.
Yeah, and I think it's worth mentioning, too, that the mugger is armed with, well, he's armed with different things, and we'll see that later. But what we see him carrying most is a nightstick studded with what look like nails.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's he may not be trying to necessarily kill anybody, but he's certainly going to hurt someone.
Yeah, that's the one thing that I found a little, I was going to say this for later, but we might as well talk about it now because I brought it up. You know, he's supposed to be relatively nonviolent, like the gun without bullets, right, should be enough to scare a lone person into giving them their wallet or their purse, right? Carrying that implies a little bit more physical violence. It's funny to say that, but it's you know, he might actually be tempted to use it. And then, like, he does hurt, I guess it's the cop's hand. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. I might not have been quite as quick to forgive as Wes, but that's why he's the hero, not me.
Well, going back to his first appearance in the first chapter, when he's actually holding both weapons, he's holding a gun in one hand and the nail stick in the other one. It's like, okay, you're trying to mug somebody, you're trying to get their money when both of your hands are full. Like, right. That implies amateurish, but also like kind of like a desperation. Like, again, like, I think you're right. Like, he wants to scare them to get the money, but like, it's almost like as weapons, these are overkill. You're like not effective when you combine them together and everything, because you need a hand free in order to do the business that you're doing. But so I just think, I think that almost more of that, like, kind of suggested the fact that he doesn't really know what he's doing. This isn't a skilled job. So,
yeah, good point. Right.
And yeah. And, just as a little, touchstone, Diane was seeing the movie You Can't Take It With You. Yeah.
Oh, and we should note the art was by Peter Snijberg, who most of us would know him from Starman and Books of Magic.
Are we supposed to know Lily? I mean, we've met so many of Diane's friends, and I couldn't find it.
I don't remember that name.
I don't think so. It is interesting. I'm wondering if that's a plot, a seed for a future plot, Max, because she has a lot of things to think about Lily becoming a different person. So I'm wondering if Lily will pop up in a future episode.
Yeah, I was wondering the same thing. Yeah.
Because, yeah, I didn't think she's been mentioned before.
So chapter 8 is The Bystanders, and that is the artist is Dean Ormston, who worked on Books of Magic, Lucifer, Black Hammer, and we get a very sad bystander shooting here. But yeah, this is the one with the kids trying to listen to a radio show, and basically just people on the street who see the mugger running for it.
Again, so, I don't know how he could be running, because you see the clop, 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 clop. And it's got to be at least 6 inches tall. Like, if you look at page 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of the chapter, he's running. The undercover cop who's dressed as a woman shoots at him, and he goes clop, 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 clop away from her. And how do you run in those things? I don't know.
Yeah, this is also the first time we hear the mugger speak.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that we see a lot of characters, a lot of people, but we don't see a lot of faces. And I think it's kind of what we saw in the chapter with the body, where we are getting more, where in that chapter we saw Central Park as a character. I think in this one we're seeing New Yorkers as a character.
Yeah, good shot.
And but this is also where we see the cops have been working undercover, including one man who is dressed as a woman. Mm-hmm. And this is when we see the mugger use his spiked nightstick.
That's right.
Yeah, and he takes a swing at one of the cops here. And yeah, I mean, but they take a shot at him, and he manages to clop, clop out of there.
Yeah. And the mugger's lucky that the cops didn't shoot him, because the one cop who gets hurt falls into the one that's dressed like a woman. That's why he misses the shot.
Right.
And but I don't know how they didn't catch him, but
I was pissed they shot the horse. Like, yeah, that was unnecessary.
I was going to say the cops are shooting they're shooting at the mugger as he's running away. But there's a horse drawn carriage that we see earlier in the chapter. And he shoots the horse in the head. Yeah, that seems, I don't know. I mean, we've seen a lot of death in this series. For some reason, the horse bothers me.
If I can paraphrase Community, I can accept the rape, but I draw the line at animal cruelty. And then the response is, you can accept the rape?
It's like, no. And it's accidental. I mean, no one is trying to shoot the horse.
But yeah.
The
sketch artist, or the caricature artist who's sitting there, for some reason, I think this character might come back. Mm. And I don't remember. There's a story arc several arcs from now called The Return of the Scarlet Ghost. And he might be involved in that, but now I'm not so sure.
Oh, maybe. Because later in the chapter, he's calling Mystery Theater Magazine.
That was kind of the thing that set me out. That was the thing that made me think that I don't remember now. Well, I guess we'll find out in a year.
As the mugger I don't want to get too stuck on his footwear here, but he's running away there. We see a couple of guys digging a ditch for, to lay some piping in there. And as he's trying to jump over it, he clonks a guy in the head. I'm kind of wondering, is that guy dead? Is he, what happened?
Well, if they're cinder blocks, he's probably dead, but I don't, you know. Maybe they're not quite as heavy as cinder blocks. I don't know, but I hear you.
I think they're just wood, but I don't know, like, if it's supposed to, like, cover up his footprints or cover up the sound or something. Like, why would you?
Yeah.
Why would you tie these to your feet? Like.
Yeah, because he's running, but he's not necessarily running gracefully. But he does manage to get away, and that leads us to chapter 9, The Solution.
This is kind of weird, the things that you associate now, like in retrospect, because some of the shots of the mugger, because of the helmet and because his mask, like, doesn't give you like a full face. There's no mouth, there's no nose or anything like that. There's really just the circular inhuman eyes. Sometimes when I see images of the mugger, I think of the character of G.I. Robot now, in particular, like the way he's illustrated, like in the Creature Commandos cartoon and everything like that. So now that's stuck in my head.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're probably, I mean, obviously he's not a robot, right, but he probably was a soldier. I mean, that I kind of get that sense of, you know, that these are his clothes and that's his helmet.
And
he probably served in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a lot of people who serve in the military then and now, it's heavily implied that he is an immigrant. And that, mm-hmm. you know, through his, I think, Wes, in chapter 9, mentions how he's got an Eastern European accent, I believe. Mm-hmm. And we hear that in the way he speaks. You know, he says, okay, give me you things. You know, it's a broken English. And, you know, like a lot of immigrants, he seems to have come to the U.S. hoping for something better, and having a hard time of it, which eventually leads to Wes's decision to resolve it the way he does. But before that, we get a very leggy Humphreys, disguised as a woman, along with Wes in a different kind of disguise.
Yeah, I like that part. I thought that was funny. Wes says, sorry about the mustache, Humphreys, because he made him shave his mustache off. And he says, I don't care about that. It's the legs that really bother me. That was funny. That was my favorite line there.
Yeah, you know, and that gets back to what you guys were saying too. There are moments of humor in this annual, which is not always true in this series.
Yeah.
Using my Google foo of the name Amerkovich, looks like he might be Serbian, or the name is Serbian in origin. So
interesting. Okay. Yeah.
You know, and this is where also we kind of get the sense of how Wes's power might work. His precognition, where his dreams, it seems to imply that they warn him of evil, but this is more a crime of desperation. And maybe that's why he doesn't have dreams about it, because it's not an evil that needs to be stamped out. I mean, he's obviously committing crimes, but he is someone who needs help more than he needs justice.
Right. He says, you know, perhaps the park can be saved not by justice, but this time by compassion. And I thought that was a nice way to end the story.
We see Wes get disarmed again, which I kind of like. I like that Wes is not this infallible, you know, Avenger of the night.
No,
he takes his hits. And we see the mugger with whatever that those things are tied to his feet. He's trying to get away, and it kind of backfires on him. He loses his footing. Yeah. And, you know, Wes is on top of him. And to me, this was another funny scene when Wes gasses him and he says, be still, foosh, succumb, foosh, sleep, foosh. He has to give him, you know, like three doses before he goes down.
Yeah. And the guy's still not out right away. But that gives us a chance to at least tell Wes his story, which is nice.
Right. Yeah. And I do like that. I do like that series of panels. You know, it just works really well. And actually, that's one of those things that throughout this story, we get different depictions of Wes's gas gun and how it looks. And I have to say, I kind of like them all. I think all of these artists do a good job of kind of showing how this. I always get the sense that this gas lingers, you know, that it kind of sticks to you, that it becomes this cloud. It doesn't drift away really quickly. Mm. And I think all of the artists do a good job of that, showing that. I don't know what you guys think. I'm probably
no. I agree. I agree. I agree with you 100%. I like the. I mean, we're back to Guy Davis. We mentioned that at the beginning, and so it's now quote on model of what the rest of the series really kind of looks like. But I think it's great. I like a different artistic interpretations. Mm-hmm.
I forgot to mention back on chapter 5 when we see the photographer's picture of the swirling smoke. It actually has a date of June 23rd, 1938. And going back to the beginning, our first story arc was set in, was it February or March of 30? Yeah. So we're getting, all this stuff is happening, you know, just a couple of months. So
yes,
and it's progressing in time. So.
Yeah. And so we get to the end of the chapter, and our friend, what is his name? Stanislaus Emirikovic, wakes up in his bed and finds a note from the Sandman saying, look under the pillow and you will find a solution in part to your state, but treat others as you would be treated in kind or suffer a terrible fate. And he looks under his pillow and finds a wad of cash.
Yep.
You know, and it he calls out to someone who I assume is his wife. And then we go back to the precinct where the police have stuffed the mugger's costume, which was left behind, with straw in order to stand it up and I guess to to see if it matches the sketch before we come to the end. And I thought that was really interesting because to me, that stuffed costume looks so much like Sandman's doll.
Yeah, that's another
I didn't think of that one, but you're right.
I thought that was Yeah, I thought that was really kind of a cool.
Yeah, that's another one of the parallels with the mugger looking like the doll and looking like Sandman. Yeah, that's
great.
How much of that is intentional or did you, it's crazy.
Yeah. Paul, what did you think of this chapter overall?
No, I thought it was great. I had a great ending to it. We mentioned that, you know, Wes isn't infallible, but he does, you know, is able to capture him. And when he hears his story, he treats it with compassion. So I think that's great.
Right. I guess I should ask, what did you guys think of the story overall of this? How does this work as an annual?
As an annual, I think it's great. It's a self-contained story, but it uses the space because annuals are typically larger, at least double the length of a normal story. And it uses that space to tell a 9-chapter story, but each chapter has a specific voice, a distinct look, and it's all in service to one larger story that's ostensibly about this crime spree over in a location over. But you're right, it's also in its own way a love letter to Central Park, like you mentioned from the beginning. Like that's the whole story takes place there, all of our with the exception of the chapter in the DA's office. Everything else takes place in the park itself. And it's about Wes, but it's also about the park. It's also about New Yorkers. It's about the world that they're in this particular time and the way in a non-evil family man can be driven to desperation by the ways the city affects people. And, you know, the things that drive other people to evil can drive a good man just to less evil, but still something that's not irredeemable.
I like annuals that are self-contained, but fit into the greater continuity, which is exactly what Ryan just said. And I think that makes it strong. So I thought it was great. I'm a big fan of the multiple artists type of thing. You know, that's taking advantage of people who can't commit or aren't able to do a monthly book. And so I do like that. Get a little different take on all these characters from all these different artists. So I think that's what distinguishes it a bit for me.
Mm-hmm. I think that does work. And I think Matt Wagner obviously put a lot of thought, not only into this story, but how he wanted to tell it. And I think along with the artist and the chapters and the way it's structured, I think that succeeds really well.
But Max, I know it's a love letter to Central Park, but you're going to regale us with stories of some of those Central Park statues at this point, huh?
Well, I don't know about regale, but yeah. it's throughout the annual, we get a bunch of, well, first of all, Wes, this is what made me think of it. There's something called the Literary Walk in Central Park, which is the only straight and broad path in Central Park. And he starts naming some of the statues. And then later in that same chapter, he talks about the Angel of the Waters, which is a statue on top of a fountain, not too far from there. And that made me start wondering about the other statues that are featured throughout the story. And I wonder if Matt Wagner specifically called these out, or if the artist, the individual artists contributed this themselves, depending on where it was in the park, where things were happening in the park. So first in the chapter, the Eyewitness, chapter one, on the very first page, we get the Columbus Monument, which was sculpted by Gaetano Russo, which is part of Columbus Circle, which we get a nice look of in this illustration, which is at the southwest corner of Central Park. And this was erected in 1892 and leads pretty directly into the Literary Walk, which Wes mentions on the very next page. And as he mentions, this features statuary of William Shakespeare, Sir Walter Scott, Fitzgreen Halleck, who I had to look up, he is a poet, Robert Burns, and not mentioned because it didn't exist yet, but now there is a Women's Rights Pioneer Monument that was erected in 2020 as part of this literary walk, and that includes Sojourner Truth, Susan B. Anthony, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Who, if you can believe it, which is not that hard to believe, unfortunately, the only women that were depicted in Central Park before this were fictional characters.
Mm-hmm.
These were the first historical women to be, you know, to have statues of them in the park.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. later, Diane mentions Beethoven. She, you know, she does the famous the dun 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 dun, the Fifth Symphony. That is at the other end of the walk, which is not part of the literary walk. It's at part of the concert ground. And then, of course, the Angel of the Waters that I mentioned before, which is by Emma Stebbins, that sits on top of the Bethesda Fountain. That was officially completed in 1873, and that is the earliest public artwork by a woman to ever be erected in New York City at all, much less the park.
Wow.
So, and then skipping ahead to chapter 3, we see someone with a bow crouched, holding a dog. And Wes is himself crouched behind it in a very similar posture, which I thought was kind of neat. And that statue is Indian Hunter by John Quincy Adams Ward. And that depicts a Native American man who is hunting with his dog. That is near the literary walk. So if you were to put a pin in all of these statues, you would see that Sandman is pretty much sticking to a specific area of the park. He's not wandering the entire park looking for the mugger. He is staying in one place, more or less. He's staying in a particular area.
And that's a very symbolic statue for that, because Sandman is on the hunt. So, of course, having him is standing next to a statue of a hunter, with the hunting dog as well.
Yeah, and that continues later in that same chapter. We see Sandman sitting on a statue of a big cat, a panther or a cougar, and that is actually, that statue is called Still Hunt by Edward Kemmes, and that depicts an American panther perched on a rock above a walkway near East Drive and 76th Street entrance of the park. Reporters at the time, when it was unveiled in 1883, wrote that some spectators were actually frightened by by the realistic depiction. It's a large statue. And it continues to startle unsuspecting park visitors today. So, yeah. So, Ryan, I think you're onto something with, you know, he is on the hunt. You know, we see Indian Hunter and we see the Still Hunt. And, yeah, that is exactly what Wes is doing. So in Chapter 5, The Cop, while he's walking his beat, we get a look at Cleopatra's Needle, which is an obelisk carved from a single piece of granite around 1450 B.C., in Egypt, and it was installed in the park in January 1881, across from the Metropolitan Museum of Art. This obelisk actually has a twin that was uncovered at the same time, and that's in London. In Chapter 6, there is a monument. You can kind of see it's large. You can see people walking around it. They look very small compared to the monument. This one is the only one that I could not say for sure what it is, which statue it is. I don't know if it's the way it's depicted or if my own Google foo was not as strong, but I believe that is the Daniel Webster Monument. I think that is it, because the statue of an American statesman who was known as an orator, which makes sense why it might appeal to the district attorney. But this statue is 14 feet tall and stands on top of a 20-foot pedestal. So it is quite large. And finally, in Chapter 7, as we mentioned before, the mugger is hiding in a statue of figures also wearing, you know, World War II soldiers' uniforms and helmets. And that is the 107th United States Infantry Memorial for soldiers who died in World War I. That was dedicated on September 29th, 1927. So it's only about 10 years old in the Sandman timeline. And the sculptor who created this was a sergeant himself who served with the infantry. I thought it was interesting how the artists included art to both symbolize what was going on in the story and also to kind of give us a map of where the Sandman was and where the muggings themselves were taking place.
I would bet money that was Matt Wagner or Steven Siegel, that it was in the script. Because knowing that you have to coordinate with so many different artists and kind of keep a sense of the location and these themes, I'm almost positive they would have had the note of which statue. Not all of these artists would have been based in New York, probably. So they might have needed like photo reference and sending pictures along with the script pages. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I thought it was, it gives it that sense of, again, you know, they're using Central Park as a character, but it's also like this whole series, it's very much based in, for now, it's very much based in the real world. You know, we don't have a lot of fantastical things happening. We don't have people flying through the sky yet. You know, we don't have any of that. This is very ground level, based in reality kind of stuff. And I think having these statues, because it would have been very easy to just draw park benches and trees and, you know, and leave it at that. But I think this kind of helps ground it even more in the sense of it being a real place.
I agree with that 100%. Cool. Thanks, Max. That was awesome. I love that kind of stuff. In terms of favorite chapter, I think it's tough. I liked the chapter with Humphreys because I thought that was really good for understanding him in our greater storyline. I liked the chapter by Alex Ross, not just for the art, but also because we find out a little bit more about what's going on. But I think my favorite has to be the mugger where Diane sort of gets away with just walking through by luck. And that has to be my favorite. How about you guys?
I like the butler for the obvious reasons. It gives us a lot more depth into a character that we've seen almost every issue, but knew precious little about. So to actually flush him out, that was a treat to read and just kind of know more about him. In terms of my favorite chapter, I didn't think about it until we were kind of discussing these, but I really like chapter 5, the cop, and chapter 8, the bystanders, because those are the ones that really take us through the park with lots of different characters kind of spurted throughout in the way either the mugger or Sandman is kind of running through the lives of these people or just kind of like trying to go about their day, their business or something. And just as they kind of see, what the heck is passing by me? You know, who is this masked guy? Maybe the cop is my favorite chapter. Kind of surprising, but I don't know. I also like the body one just because of the weird alternate take on like a voice from a past dead, but.
Yeah, and actually for me, chapter 5, The Cop, is my favorite. And I'm glad we're going by favorite chapters and not favorite moments, because there are a lot of great moments in this comic. As you were saying, Ryan, you know, we're seeing different people kind of just going about their day in this chapter. You know, we're getting the desk sergeant, we're getting the cop, we're getting Fiji, the photographer, who I love the way the cop describes him as a photographer making his living snapping photos of what we see every day. You know, it sounds kind of dismissive. Like, I don't know how he makes a living taking pictures of things that are just out there. I like the dialogue, but I really love the art. That's what kind of really sells me on this chapter. It's just really, really atmospheric. It's got a lot of the sense of a night where there are obviously a lot of people. We see people in the park, even though it's late, but we see people still using the park, walking around the park. Some people are, you know, doing secret stuff in the shadows, but there are also just like families walking around. And because someone says at some point that it's hot, it's the summer, and people are just trying to get out of the heat of their apartments and, you know, homes, and so they're doing that in the park. And we also get that wonderful panel of Sandman sitting in a tree, him running away and the cop trying to find him. And, you know, we also get a big splash panel of Wes running into the photographer. He loses his gun. The camera goes flying. You know, he's trying to, and that's when we get that panel with the flash, you know, and it's all black and white at the same time that, Sandman is shooting his gun. And, you know, he's like, "I got you, bastard. I got you." But he didn't get anything. You know, he just got the smoke cloud. You know, it says the photo says Central Park mugger first encounter. And I just love how, speaking as someone who has worked as a professional journalist, how everything about that is wrong. it's not the mugger. And it's not even his first. Well, I mean, it's the first encounter, but all you see is smoke. You don't see anything.
Right.
And so I thought that was kind of a nice little joke slid in there. In a series of really great chapters, this is probably the one I keep coming back to.
Mm-hmm.
Something we asked, did this advance the story of Wesley and Diane? And I think it's a resounding yes.
Yeah, I mean, we see them a couple of times. They're on dates. They're clearly in love with each other. As you mentioned, they're horny for each other. We see that in the first chapter, in the chapter when they see her dad, and they're clearly a couple. So we'll see again, where does this, is this taking place in the middle of the Scorpion story arc, or is this a while afterwards? And if it is a while afterwards, then that may foreshadow something coming, way events play out in the next story arc or two, in terms of her awareness of Sandman's, or of her awareness of Wesley's other activities.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you that it takes place in the middle of the last story arc.
What do you think it does for Wes and Diane's relationship, Paul?
Well, compared to her finding out that he's Sandman, not a lot, right? But compared to like a regular couple's evolution, you see them more comfortable with each other. They're clearly a couple. They're walking close together. They're, you know, all those types of things. So I think it depends on which aspect you're looking at.
Like I said, I think it definitely moves it forward. But the way it does it is very subtle. It's not like the big reveal yet or anything like that. But they are obviously very, very comfortable with each other. Again, you know, Matt Wagner is very good at pushing us to the brink of that and not quite taking us over. And so I think that works. But I think because we've seen Wes kind of wrestle with, you know, should I tell her? What am I going to tell her? And all, you know, how do I feel? And all these things. And he just seems to be absolutely smitten with her. And I think, you know. I think I say this every time, but I think we're going to see that soon. You know, and I enjoy it. I really enjoy seeing Wes and Diane's relationship.
Yeah, I agree.
So we're going to take a promo break, and we will be back with a review of a Golden Age Sandman story.
Transmitter device activated. Coordinates set for Earth 2.
In 1961, in the pages of issue 123 of The Flash, Barry Allen, the Silver Age Flash of Earth 1, travelled to another dimension, met Jay Garrick, the Golden Age Flash of Earth 2, and the DC Multiverse as we know it was born.
And in 1985, after many years of cross-dimensional adventures, DC Comics published the cataclysmic Crisis on Infinite Earths, and the DC Multiverse was gone.
But did you know that Barry Allen's Flash was not the first hero to meet a version of himself from another dimension?
Did you know that Jay Garrick wasn't even the first Golden Age character to return in the Silver Age of comics?
The scope of the pre-crisis DC multiverse reaches far beyond Earth 1 and Earth 2.
And the legacy of DC's Golden Age characters is a lot wider than the heroes you know, like Flash, Green Lantern, Sandman and Starman.
On the Earth 2 podcast, we navigate the pre-crisis DC Comics multiverse of universes and other dimensions.
And we celebrate and explore the legacy of DC's Golden Age characters, including the legendary Justice Society of America, and a lot more besides.
So join me, Peter Watson.
And me, David Steele, and our occasional guests of friends, family and fellow podcasters.
For weekly dramatic readings and analysis of the pre-crisis DC Comics multiverse and the legacy of their Golden Age characters through the Silver and Bronze Ages of comics.
On
the Earth 2 podcast.
Transmatter Cube activated. Return coordinates set for Earth Prime.
All right, welcome back, everybody. We are going to talk through a little bonus story for you. Adventure Comics number 47, the Sandman story in there. It was cover dated February 1940. It was on sale January 9th, 1940. 10 cents, 64 pages for the whole magazine, edited by Vincent Sullivan. And the title of the story is Lady in Evening Clothes. It's a 10-pager written by Gardner Fox with art by Ogden Whitney. And it was reprinted once in the Golden Age Sandman archives, and that's where I'm reading it from. So the Sandman approaches D.A. Belmont to discuss the murder of Anson Port. He reaches an uneasy truce and provides Belmont with the bullet from the murder, which he has recovered. Later that night, Wes catches a woman breaking into his wall safe. The girl, Diane Ware, confesses that she is a safecracker raised by criminals. She is breaking into Wesley's safe for Black Bill Trent, who claims to have knowledge about Diane's real father. Diane, learning that Wes is the Sandman, agrees to help him catch the murderers if he helps her find her father. Diane and the Sandman return to the precinct to obtain the ballistics report, but Belmont won't provide it, so Wes gasses him. While Diane tries to crack the safe, Crook surprises them right in the middle of the precinct and forces Diane to open the safe while Wes waits outside. But Sandman enters the room and is wounded while gassing the thugs. With Diane out cold, Wes drives into the country until he finally collapses and crashes his car. Thinking quickly, Diane enlists the help of a farmer and Wes is able to recover. He and Diane get evidence from Black Bill that implicates him and Trigger Hunt in the murder. Sandman then brings the evidence to the district attorney, who wants to arrest the crime fighter. But Sandman also provides D.A. Belmont with evidence that Diane is his daughter. Reunited with his lost family, the D.A. gratefully allows the Sandman to leave. The end. So, what do you guys think of this? Let's talk through it.
It's basically the same as Sandman Mystery Theater. It's the same way. It's the same tone.
I loved it. It is just the right amount of Golden Age crazy.
Yeah, I love it too. I think it's great. I think the art is very good. You know, again, by Ogden Whitney. You know, Diane is beautiful in this and clearly has the hots for Wes right from the get-go, which I thought was pretty funny when she meets him in his apartment. I don't know. I just think it's great. And then, you know, you read this Sandman archives, you see how she helps him later on, very similar to how she is going to be helping him in this series. So I just thought that part of it's great.
And I mean, that's kind of like one of the reasons why we selected this one. It's her first appearance, but she's also a very different, she's a Golden Age femme fatale at first. Right. She's a criminal when we meet her, but she's drawn to him. He's drawn to her. She'll end up becoming a good guy once he reveals the secret about her, that she doesn't have to resort to this life of crime. So the same, almost like a Selina Kyle type or any other one of dozens of these female type of characters. But it's nice to see that right off the bat, they have this spark, this connection. The other thing is, like, I don't want to like complain about decompression storytelling in modern comics, but like a lot happens in this story in like 10 pages. It's like you go through like one page, six panels of this book would be like 16 pages of a regular book. Like this could flesh out a whole story arc and just like what they could do in 10 pages in this.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
And she's good at it too. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Max.
No, she is. No, and I was just going to say that this reminds me also of a little bit of the spirit. With his femme fatales and, you know, I believe one is called Sand.
Sand Serif.
Yeah. You know, and, this is a very different kind of Diane. She's, but very similar in some ways. You know, she has a lot of confidence. She's not afraid to mix it up, but at the same time, she's basically kind of a border. Well, she is a criminal. She's a safecracker.
But doing it under somewhat of duress. Right. So I think it is. I mean, Wes and the DA do accept her very quickly, which I think is humorous. But things happen faster, not just in the 1930s, but in comics back then, too. So, well, okay.
Right. And I thought it was funny because at one point in a great panel, Sandman is shooting his gas gun. The bad guys are shooting their machine guns at him. Diane is attacking one of the shooters from behind.
Yeah.
And the Sandman takes a bullet. I believe. And he's losing blood and they end up crashing in the car as they're trying to make a getaway. And they end up spending a couple of weeks at a farm, at someone's farm, you know, and I thought that was great. And everyone, you know, the farmer's like, okay, well, you know, see you later.
That's the connection between these two stories. Wes gets hurt and crashes his car. Same thing in the annual.
Yeah, but you know, I like the way Diane just kind of jumps in and is so enamored of the Sandman right from the beginning. And it's worth mentioning also, Wes says, "Oh, I dare you to crack my safe."
Yeah,
and she does.
And it's Sandman's outfit right there.
His outfit there, which was a hell of a gamble for Wes to take. But you know, from right from the beginning, she's enamored of Wes and his adventuring lifestyle, and you know, and we take that sharp turn with the finding out she's the daughter of the DA.
But the couple weeks they spend at the farm is basically three panels. Of the story, and they talk about a week of healthy living that makes them all better, and then they are, when they go back to the apartment, they're just sitting down having a smoke.
Oh, there is so much smoking in this story.
But it's fun. And it's a 1940s adventure story. It's much lighter. It's much more superhero-y. It could have used a little bit more heartbreaking poverty and child abuse for my taste, that it would put it more in the realm that we're used to covering. But
but what is good is on more than one occasion, Diane's driving the car, and she does that a lot in future issues, again in this archive, and so, you know, she was a
forward,
like that
progressive woman right from the beginning.
I'm sure there were a lot of women in 1938 that weren't even driving, so that's great.
And she is also she pursues Sandman, she pursues the Wesley, you know, it's not the other way around, you know, he's not going, hey baby, you know, it's her.
Yeah
you know, so yeah, and you know, so the seeds of the Diane that we get in Sandman Mr. Theater are, they're here. Mm-hmm. You know, this takes a little different direction.
Yeah. Gene pulls his mask off at the end, giving him a great big kiss. I thought that was a riot. You know, it's terrific. I just think it's great.
So does he do that in front of the DA? Does the DA?
Well, maybe the DA turned his back while he was, you know, he was letting them have a moment of intimacy. He says, "That girl, I bet she'll get me into some other scrapes soon, but she's a swell partner in a pinch." And that's just like our Diane, swell partner in a pinch. I think that's great.
Exactly.
So anyway, I love this little story. So I'm hopefully listeners, you did too. Let us know if you want us to do more Golden Age Sandmans every once in a while.
And with that, we're going to run a few promos and then we'll be back with some listener feedback.
A long time ago, in a comic book rack far, far away. During the years between The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, Marvel Comics kept the Star Wars magic alive, delivering bold new stories, expanding the mythology, and taking our favorite heroes and villains on unforgettable adventures. Now join me, the irredeemable Shag, and an ever-changing roster of guest hosts as we journey back to this incredible era. We begin with a comic adaptation of The Empire Strikes Back and continue through the thrilling tales leading up to Return of the Jedi. If you're a seasoned Star Wars veteran who knows your Shira Bree from your hoojibs, or a brave explorer venturing into these comics for the first time, this is your hyperspace lane to classic Star Wars adventure. Join us for Marvel Star Wars, From Empire to Jedi, every other month on the Fire and Water Podcast Network, beginning in June 2025.
Welcome back. We're going to do some listener feedback for our last show with the Scorpion. Alex Osias said, "This was an interesting storyline, with the Scorpion being a mass criminal with an unusual weapon that kills, very pulpish, and some skill with the weapon and handling poisons that almost brings him up to the level of Wesley. The nice thing is that despite all Wesley's advantages and skills, he's not at JSA level yet, and so his challenges are not only dealing with criminals, but also the police. And pretty much anyone that could interfere or oppose him. The challenge level is high, and so are the stakes for the Sandman at this level. Also great to see how competence and incompetence in the police force are balanced to give Wesley and the Scorpion breaks, but also put them both in jeopardy, making for an interesting triangle of sides that isn't always balanced in these stories." Yeah, that's true. Alex, thanks a lot.
Our buddy Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog Comic Box Commentary said, "As you all say, after exsanguination, child abuse, incest, and death, I think I needed an arc with a silly cowboy villain." Whew, pretty cool. "Nothing to add to the discussion of the story other than to say I find the Wes-Diane interaction so charming, as we all do."
Yeah. Next up, Bucky749 says, "I heard on the Fantastic Four that Shag pays you guys. Does he pay you like a normal job, or do you get a per-episode expense map? Also, how did they get you to agree to be on the network?" So, Bucky, I don't know about Ryan or Max, but, you know, I get a, you know, flat check of $10,000 a month from Shag just to, you know, be there. And, you know, he basically flew up here and asked me to be on the show, and that's how I got started. So how about you guys?
I think I need to talk to HR.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I know we're not supposed to talk about it, but nobody, you know, nobody will hear us. Yeah.
I'll just say my signing bonus wasn't worth it.
Tim Price from the Outcasters on the Right On Network said, "You guys nailed it with the theme being money, or I might say wealth. There were many scenes showing the thoughts and acts of the privileged and how they take their way of life for granted. Wes does not, nor does Diane, but they're surrounded by those who do. The Scorpion's motivation was not that the investors cheated his family, but they didn't know how to deal with that life. It's like the stories of lottery winners who make awful choices. Sudden wealth can be very self-destructive, leading to Terry's anger and jealousy of those with wealth that are living well." Fascinating reading. Yeah, we mentioned that in our recording. And yeah, that was a nice little twist. You know, the Scorpion was not really right about his motivations.
Tim went on to say, "One technical issue that kept bugging me, and I just looked again in issue 20 to verify I wasn't imagining it. When Terry brands something, the burn has the same shape as the brand, but it shouldn't. The burn should be the mirror image of the brand, and yet that burn image is the same throughout the story. Or am I missing something? Honestly, I normally don't look to catch things like that, but it just jumped out at me." Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's just an artistic gaffe.
Next up, our pal, Fire and Water All-Star Chris Franklin from Supermates, Batman Nightcast, and the Mr. and Mrs. Superman said, "An entertaining episode as always, gents, but I'm disappointed. No matter how many times the word was said, not once did we hear the famous musical sting when the word whip was uttered. Come on, Ryan. You can't let that die. Ryan, I'll let you answer that."
Chris, I actually had a note to use that sound effect like a year ago when we were first kind of mapping out some of this podcast. I had that note to revisit that sound effect for that episode. Completely forgot about it. So I'll use it when we're talking about this question, and I promise I will have occasion to revisit that character again someday. Just so I can
somehow use it. I doubt it's the last time a whip will come up in this comic book. given the nature of this comic book.
Dave Tomko said, "I love the pacing of Wes and Diane's romance, especially how it's balanced with Wes being racked with guilt over his dishonesty and Diane slowly piecing together his dual identity. I can't wait to see how this plays out in the next arc." Yeah, that's one of my favorite parts about this whole series so far.
Rich said, "That cover on issue 19 is baffling. If there's any meaning there at all, I can't see it." We kind of had that same problem, although Scott Arthur left a comment kind of giving a more detailed explanation of what was going on. So,
well, thanks, everybody, for all your comments. We love it. But now we're going to move on to the dream sequence. Last time, the dream sequence question was, who was your favorite animal-themed supervillain? And our bonus question was, your favorite Western movie or show? So, Max, why don't you tell us what some of the listeners said?
Well, Dr. Ange chimed in with animal-themed villains. He mentioned Lizard in the Lab Coat, which is, if you're going to do the lizard, you have to do the Lizard in the Lab Coat. Dave Stevens' Catwoman in Who's Who, and old-school Cheetah. Tim Price said Marvel's Scorpion. Brett Young chose Doc Ock, and his 9-year-old agreed with that. Chris Franklin chose Catwoman, and also gave us a shout-out to original gangster Killer Croc and classic Lab Coat Lizard. Dave Tomko chose Cheetah, especially when Greg Rucka writes her. Scott Arthur came up with Catwoman, Mandrill, both versions of the Viper, and Le Beaver from Howard the Duck.
In terms of favorite Westerns, Dr. Ange said The Magnificent Seven and The Quick and the Dead. Tim Price said The Cisco Kid, The Lone Ranger, Unforgiven, Blazing Saddles, and, no judgment, Back to the Future Part 3. Bucky said a John Wayne movie called The Lucky Texan. Brett Young said, well, he was named after Brett Maverick, so he has to put that one up there. He also mentioned the show Justified, which is based on some great Elmore Leonard books. I went through an Elmore Leonard phase when I was reading a bunch of his stuff. He mentioned the show Deadwood, the movies The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, The Quick and the Dead, and Blazing Saddles. Chris Franklin mentioned Tombstone, The Outlawed Josie Wales, Unforgiven, Open Range, Shane, High Noon, and The Searchers. I like The Searchers, too. There's a shot in The Searchers. It's a John Ford movie, and there's a famous shot in it that influenced the scene from the first Star Wars movie when Luke returns to his homestead to see his aunt and uncle's home burning. And then Scott Arthur said The Magnificent Seven, The Rifleman, and Gunsmoke. I don't think, actually answered this question last time because we kind of came up with it at the end, but I've been thinking about it. The TV show Deadwood is like a top five all-time favorite show for me, so I would rank that as one of my favorite Westerns. My favorite Western movie is probably a cheat because it doesn't take place in the West. It's the movie Copland, starring Sylvester Stallone, Robert De Niro, Harvey Keitel. It's set in New Jersey in like the late 70s or early 80s. But structurally, it's about a small town sheriff bringing law back to this kind of lawless community, even though it's all corrupt cops. And it ends with like a shootout and everything. Like, you map the structure of this movie and it's an old West. It's a Wild West or a Western movie. It fits into those perfectly. It just happens to be set in the small Jersey town across the bridge from New York City. And James Mangold also did the remake of 310 to Yuma. So he knows Westerns. So, Max, what's your favorite Western?
You know, that's a tough one. I'm a fan of Sam Raimi's The Quick and the Dead, because it is very Sam Raimi. I spoke on a podcast with Rob Kelly on his show Fade Out about the Shootist, a John Wayne movie, his last movie, which is also a very good Western, just because it's so out of type for John Wayne. But I think my favorite is probably Pale Rider, Clint Eastwood.
Okay.
Just because it was sort of more of a modern Western. Because I'm a fan of Outlaw Josie Wales, too, which was one of his. And Two Mules for Sister Sarah. I mean, he did so many. But Pale Rider was kind of more of a modern Western for him. Also a sneaky man with no name movie without being a man with no name movie. I just really enjoy the acting and the cinematography, especially on that movie, which is set in the mountains. It's just a beautiful movie to look at. And a typically brutal Clint Eastwood Western.
Yeah.
Paul, what did you have?
I really struggled with this because I'm not as big a movie buff as you guys, as you know, and I really haven't watched hardly any Westerns. So I don't know that I'm a good person to make a judgment. I have seen Tombstone and enjoy that. I know that one's one of my dad's favorites because he went for about 5 years after watching that movie. He went around saying, "I'm your Huckleberry" all the time. So that has stuck with me. And I'm going to have to go with that because that's the best I can do. But I'll have to point out, I did, though, the last couple of weeks, just read the recent DC Finest Western book that came out like 3 or 4 weeks ago and tremendously enjoyed it. I mean, there are some really good stories as the first part of it has a lot of stories about outlaw. And which was about it. And then it also had, and then at the end of it had the first few Jonah Hex stories. I have read plenty of Jonah Hex and I do like Jonah Hex, but overall, I know that Rob has talked about the Son of Tomahawk, and all 10 of the Son of Tomahawk stories are also in this book, and they were terrific. So I have to say that was I do recommend that as a read. So
cool.
All right. Well, we're going to move on this time. The dream sequence question, and I picked this one, and it's kind of the only time we could do this, because we did an annual this time. Guys, what is your favorite comic book annual? So, Max, let's start with you. What's your favorite annual?
Well, first of all, I want to say I'm mad at you for coming up with this question. This is such a hard question. You know, and I went back and forth on this, and the Superman annual with
The Man Who Has Everything.
Yeah, The Man Who Has Everything.
Alan Moore, yep.
And everything, yep. You know, that of course is a classic. I used to be a very big fan of X-Men annuals, because those were kind of, a lot of times they were Chris Claremont, the writer, just kind of letting loose.
Art Adams and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but as I went back on them, you know, they don't really quite hold up the way you might want to. They're a little too jokey. One X-Men annual that I did like was X-Men annual number 5, which unfortunately is called Ooh La La Badoon, which is a cool story that teams up the X-Men with Fantastic Four. And I had no idea. Apparently there was a story that led into it, but you know, back in the newsstand days, you just kind of took what you could get, and you had, if you didn't know what was going on, it was no big deal. And so that remains a favorite. But the one I actually chose was New Teen Titans number 2, which is The Vigilante, where the Vigilante makes his first appearance. Viper makes her first appearance. Oh, who else makes their first appearance? Give me a second, solid. It'll come to me. Someone else makes their first appearance here. But it's well drawn, well told. It gives hints of what's going on, what's going to happen with the Monitor later in Crisis on Infinite Earths, because at this point, you know, the Monitor was being seeded into different stories as kind of a power broker. We also get a little bit of foreshadowing on the Judas Contract, which is, of course, is probably the Teen Titans story. And we get a very angry Robin, you know, who's, you know, just looking for, you know, a little revenge. And he's just going around kicking people in the face.
And angry at Adrian Chase. Yeah, it's great. Great.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and there's a bit of unfortunate characterization that gets sort of saved later. But yeah, I mean, we get there's a lot happening in this, and a lot of people, a lot of the Titans actually are kind of in mortal danger. And it felt like DC trying to do their version of the Punisher, which doesn't quite work. But for this story, I thought it did. And I actually own a hard copy of it, and I will go back and read it over and over again.
Cool. How about you, Ryan? What'd you come up with?
I almost went with Fantastic Four Annual Number 6, which is the birth of Franklin Richards and also the first appearance of Annihilus. It's a great story. I've always really, really liked that one. And maybe that is actually my favorite. But the one that I thought of when we kind of came up with this question, the one that kind of leapt out at me, just because it's always, as a story, it's always stuck with me, more because of the format than anything else. And I doubt anybody else would think about this because it was actually published in this century. So our listeners probably don't remember this one. But it was New X-Men Annual from 2001. It was written by Grant Morrison when he was doing New X-Men and drawn by Lanil Francis Yu. And the thing about this annual is it's widescreen. Like, they flipped the dimensions. They put the staple on the narrow side. And, like, in 2001, like, this is when DVDs are exploding and becoming, like, almost one of the dominant physical media transfers. And everything, like, the aspect ratio thing about movies was becoming a huge concern. And DVDs could recapture that in a way that VHS didn't, because it kind of, everything, like, kind of smashed the panel in order to fit the full square TV screen. So everything felt like widescreen was the way to go. And Grant Morrison had this idea that comics should be widescreen. And because now digital comics were a thing, too. So he was imagining that comics would be read on the computer screen that way, too, or on a TV. So he thought the future of comic book as a visual medium would be in this more lengthy, like, you know, kind of wide panoramic format. And that's the way the book is drawn. So the panels are all kind of going wide. So you open it, and like, if you store this in like a bag, like you do, like when you bag and board your comics, it's sideways, it's on its side. So it's kind of weird, but it's a fun story. The art looks great. And this is, you know, this is Grant Morrison making the X-Men in his vision of how cool they should be in their, the way he does cool pseudo-sexual leather Bondage X-Men, which is, you know, that's fun. Because I was reading that book at the time, and when I got that annual, I was like, this is the future of comics. They're all going to look like this. They're all going to be printed on their side and be widescreen. And, you know, as brilliant as Grant can be and as prescient as he has been sometimes, this one was swing and a miss. This was the NFT of, of, you know, comic book annuals.
Awesome. That's great. So it's funny, Max, when you start talking about New Teen Titans Annual number 2, I actually, my first came to mind was the fact that if you look at the first three New Teen Titans Annuals, they are all home runs. Okay. The number 2 you talked about, which is first of Vigilante. Number 3 is part of the Judas contract, right? And the final chapter of it. And number 1, though, is the one I would have picked. It's the conclusion of the Titans in space to Tamaran, and there's this big battle, and the cover is just awesome. It's shot right from George Perez's pencils. It's just really it. But so in terms of the grouping of three annuals in a row, I don't think you can beat that. But what I eventually went with is a sentimental favorite, and I'm holding the facsimile edition right now of Amazing Spider-Man Annual number 1. So this is the first appearance of the Sinister Six, where all of the Spidey villains get together. It's by Lee and Ditko. And Ditko does a splash page of each villain as they are fighting Spider-Man. And this is just a fantastic comic. It's a great story. Very, you know, parlance of my other show, very special for the time. Not only do you get this extra long story, but then there are all these pinups with histories of all the Spidey characters and all those villains throughout the rest of the comic. So I just think this was a great, and then a recap of Spidey's origin and situation. There's a map of his house and his classmates and guest stars. So it's just fantastic annual altogether. So that's why it's a favorite of mine. So
good choice.
Listeners, let us know what your favorite annual is in the comments as you make your comments on this episode.
Yeah, I think that's going to be it for this one.
That's it.
Listeners, hope you enjoyed this episode. We'll be back, hopefully, later on this summer to talk about the next story arc where Sandman fights the Whip. No, I'm joking. He's actually fighting somebody named Dr. Death. Anyway, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please support us by subscribing to Justice Society Presents on your preferred podcast app. You can also help us promote the show on social media by liking and reposting.
As I mentioned, you can also leave comments at our website at fireandwaterpodcast.com under the show notes for the JSA Presents.
Finally, please consider supporting the network on Patreon at patreon.com/FWpodcasts.
And as always, thanks everyone for listening, and until next time, pleasant dreams.
Moonlight and shadows and you in my arms, and the melody in the bamboo tree, my sweet. Even in shadows I feel no alarm, while you hold me tight in the jungle night, my sweet. Close to my...